From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld put his foot in it following an unexpected question from an unexpected quarter.
Why do we soldiers have to dig through local landfills for pieces of scrap metal and compromised ballistic glass to up-armor our vehicles? And why don't we have those resources readily available to us?
To which Rumsfeld replied,
"It's a matter of production and capability of doing it. As you know, you go to war with the army you have, not the army you might want or wish to have at a later time."
For us, it offered more than insight into the mind of the Secretary of Defense. It demonstrated an unexpected benefit of embedding reporters with our troops. In this case, the reporter, Lee Pitts of the Chattanooga Times Free Press, had embedded that question with a soldier. On Wednesday, he sent this letter to a colleague at his paper.
He wrote, "I just had one of my best days as a journalist today. As luck would have it, our journey north was delayed just long enough so I could attend a visit today here by Defense Secretary Rumsfeld. I was told yesterday that only soldiers could ask questions, so I brought two of them along with me as my escorts. Beforehand, we worked on questions to ask Rumsfeld about the appalling lack of armor their vehicles going into combat have." Pitts wrote his colleague that he'd been trying to get the story of inadequate armor out for weeks, and in fact, his paper had printed two stories about it. But now the national press was all over it, and that, he said, felt great. Quote, "This is what the job is all about. People need to know. The soldier who asked the question said he felt good because he took his complaints to the top. When he got back to his unit, most of the guys patted him on the back. But a few of the officers were upset because they thought it would make them look bad."
Or maybe that the soldier was manipulated by an embedded reporter. Did this transaction amount to journalistic subterfuge, tricking a government official into answering a question in a forum from which journalists were barred? Or was it merely a natural, if unconventional, response to the Bush administration's avowed determination to avoid the filter of an independent press? Maybe a little bit of both. But it does show that sometimes ordinary people can and will conspire to ensure that the filter doesn't filter out what the public needs and wants and has the right to know.
This week, TV reporter Jim Tarakani in Providence, Rhode Island, received a sentence of 6 months home confinement for refusing to name a source. Also this week, Time magazine reporter Matt Cooper and New York Times reporter Judy Miller appeared in court, also for refusing to tell the name of a source. They each face up to 18 months in jail. Now, prosecutors say that Cooper and Miller are obligated to tell investigators who leaked them the name of CIA agent Valerie Plame because that leaker broke a federal law. They don't have any protection because in the 1970s, the Supreme Court decided in Brandsburg v. Hayes that reporters are not like attorneys or spouses. They have no federal shield against testifying in criminal cases. Many states disagree and have passed shield laws to protect journalists. Law professor Jeffrey Stone supports the creation of a federal shield for reporters, but in its absence, he says they should not place themselves above the law. Jeff, welcome to OTM.
I'm delighted to be here.
So you say it's a matter of journalists behaving according to the shield rules that they wish were in place rather than according to the rules that are in place.
Precisely right.
But why oughtn't they go ahead and promise confidentiality if they're prepared to provide it?
Well, we do not live in a society where individuals ordinarily ought to violate the law simply because they think that they have good reasons for doing so.
So how do you think Matthew Cooper or Judith Miller should have played their cards?
They should have promised their sources that they would protect confidentiality to the extent allowed by law, and that they should act in accord with the law when they lose as well as when they win. And thus far, on this issue in 19 states and in the federal court system, journalists haven't been able to persuade legislators or courts that there is a legal basis for a privilege. And as long as that remains the state of the law, they should act accordingly.
Right. So the Supreme Court says reporters don't have an automatic privilege under the Constitution, but 31 states say, but we're going to extend that privilege to journalists anyway, just as it's been extended to priests and psychologists and so forth.
And attorneys, right.
And attorneys. Now, what are the impediments now against a federal shield law?
those who have opposed it have essentially made the argument that, unlike the attorney-client situation, unlike the doctor-patient situation, that the source-journalist relationship is one in which most people, in fact, are willing to tell the journalist whatever it is they want the journalist to know, with or without a promise of confidentiality. And therefore, the actual amount of information that dries up in the absence of a privilege is negligible. If you look at the 19 states that don't have privileges, it's not at all obvious that the reporters there do any less good a job than in the 31 states in which there are privileges. Again, I don't support that argument, but that's the argument that's made. And it's not an implausible argument.
I've read that one reason why a federal shield law hasn't passed is because even some journalists are divided about it.
It does create some serious problems. One is, of course, the concern that many people have about the unduly extensive use of confidential sources on the part of journalists. And that may not be a healthy thing in journalism. And the other point, of course, is a much more troubling one to me, which is, how do you define who's eligible for the privilege? Is a student reporter on a student newspaper eligible for the privilege? Is someone who runs a blog eligible? Who is a journalist for this purpose? That's actually a very serious question, and also a very dangerous one, because as a general matter, we have shunned the idea of licensing journalists. I mean, is everybody who keeps a diary a journalist? Is everybody who writes letters a journalist?
Yikes. Let's say they did pass a federal shield law. Would this have protected, should this have protected, people like Matthew Cooper and Judith Miller?
Actually, I think not. And here's the reason. The privilege, when it does exist, belongs to the person who is making the communication. That's particularly relevant in the situation involving Valerie Plame, because the reason for giving the privilege is to encourage sources to communicate information that is of public interest that they may otherwise be reluctant to communicate. But in this situation, what we have is, allegedly, White House officials outing a CIA agent in order to serve partisan political purposes in violation of a clear federal statute that makes it a crime for a government official to reveal that information. This is not a whistleblowing case.
So Matthew Cooper, who merely repeated Novak's charges and attributed them to Novak, and Judith Miller, who wrote nothing at all about Valerie Plame, were prosecuted because they wouldn't reveal their sources. Meanwhile, Bob Novak, who went ahead and disclosed the information, is entirely absent from this drama so far. We don't know what happened to him. Why hasn't he been brought before the bar?
Well, the key thing you said is we don't know. I'm quite confident that Bob Novak has been questioned by the grand jury. Patrick Fitzgerald, the prosecutor here, is a tough, hard-nosed prosecutor. I have no doubt that when all the dust settles, we will find out what has happened with Bob Novak and that his situation will not be a terribly happy one.
Well, what do you think happened with Bob Novak? What are the options? One option, obviously, is that he revealed the source, in which case, why are these other reporters being prosecuted? And the other is that he hasn't revealed the source, in which case, why isn't he being charged?
Well, if he did reveal the source, then the prosecutor still might want additional information that corroborates it, because in a criminal prosecution, you do need to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And so it would make perfect sense for Fitzgerald to want the additional information. Other alternative is that Novak did not disclose the information, did not answer the questions, not by asserting the First Amendment, as Miller and Cooper did, but instead by asserting the privilege against self-incrimination, saying that he believes he could be prosecuted for having publicly disclosed the information. And there's no question that he then does have a privilege under the Constitution to refuse to answer those questions unless the prosecutor decides to grant him immunity.
That's kind of ironic, don't you think? If he committed a crime, he has the right to protect himself. Judith Miller and Matthew Cooper, who did not commit a crime, have no such right.
Well, Judith Miller and Matthew Cooper will have committed a crime when they refuse to disclose the information. And again, you have to look at this when all the dust settles, not right now, which is in the middle of the process.
Jeff, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Jeffrey Stone is author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime. We're joined now by one of the reporters in question, Time Magazine's Matthew Cooper. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brooke.
We spoke to a law professor and author, Jeffrey Stone, who studied these issues closely, and he said the presumption has always been that the privilege is to protect the source, but if the source has committed a crime and his information does not advance the public good, then there's no need to extend a privilege like this.
Well, the thing is, I mean, for reporters, just as a practical question, one cannot in the habit of kind of picking and choosing which confidences to honor and which ones you'll dispense with because you may not like the motivations of your sources. If I render a promise, I'm going to do my best to keep it, and that's what we're trying to do in this case.
How do you weigh your journalistic principles against the need to find out who in the White House committed what is a serious crime?
Look, it's in the nature of these privileges that there are times when they will cut into the ability of law enforcement to do what they want. For instance, right now, as Floyd Abrams, my First Amendment lawyer, has said, he knows the names of these sources. He has, you know, in order to do his job defending me and Judith Miller of the New York Times, he knows the names of these sources now. No judge on earth, no prosecutor in the United States would now go to Abrams, subpoena him, threaten him with jail, and demand that he divulge the sources. We're willing to accept those limits on questioning of lawyers because we believe in the attorney-client privilege. We're making a similar argument about journalism, and I readily acknowledge that some crimes may not be prosecuted if this privilege is upheld. But that is a social cost that I think the country should be willing to pay in order for journalists to be able to do their job.
You know, the New York Times quotes you saying, "I'm hoping the federal government is not going to put me in a position where I have to tell my 6-year-old son that I'm going away." Did the federal government put you in this position? You appear to have offered a source confidentiality that you couldn't guarantee under the current laws. You had some control over that.
Well, Brooke, as a practical matter, you know, if you're a reporter, when you're just talking with somebody on background or off the record, you don't necessarily know what they're about to say. That's part of what we're arguing. It would be impossible for journalists to be able to do interviews and, you know, constantly be reassessing, well, can I grant it here? Is this a civil privilege, a criminal case? It's just not the way journalism works. I readily acknowledge that I've offered to protect the confidentiality of my source and that has landed me in legal hot water.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brooke.
Matt Cooper is the White House correspondent for Time magazine.
Coming up, case studies in good and bad reporting and ways to control the press.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In October, the Baltimore Sun wrote a series of articles about Maryland Governor Robert Ehrlich and a supposed sweetheart deal selling state land to politically connected private developers. A few weeks later, a Sun columnist wrote that the governor's communications director was having trouble, quote, keeping a straight face while denying charges that Ehrlich was using taxpayer money for self-promotion via state tourism ads. For Ehrlich, that was the final straw in a long war of words with the two Sun writers. And so, on November 16th, he announced that not only would he no longer speak to them, but no one in the Maryland state government could either. The Sun has filed a First Amendment lawsuit, and both sides have been arguing their cases in the court of public opinion. Abraham Dash is a professor of law at the University of Maryland Law School, and he's been looking into the legalities of this case. Professor Dash, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Do you think the Baltimore Sun has a case under the First Amendment?
I do not. The First Amendment protects the press. No one can stop them, certainly not the government, from printing anything that they have, any information. But there is no, quote, right to know. In other words, there is no First Amendment right where the press can get information from the government. A government can, if they want to, get rid of all their public information officers and not reveal any information.
Now, the Sun, as I understand, is claiming that the governor of Maryland, by refusing access to state officials to two reporters alone, is in essence dictating who may have access to news about the state. That doesn't change the legal situation at all?
If they, as an individual media, is denied access, but others, like the Washington Post, were given access to the governor, they are being denied something which arguably, under the 5th and 14th Amendment, would be a denial of some quasi-property right without due process of law. That's the only kind of argument I could see, and how valid that would be, I honestly don't know. because the high officials of federal and state governments many times will grant a personal interview with one correspondent or reporter and deny it to another.
Now, they don't call it the Fourth Estate for nothing. The framers originally understood the press as a sort of unofficial check and balance against all three other branches of government.
As you know, most of the Founding Fathers detested the press, Jefferson in particular. But at the same time, they were very strong under the First Amendment to permit a freedom of the press, meaning that the press could write whatever they wanted, even if it was, quote, scurrilous, as Jefferson would sometimes call it.
This is not the first time that either a scurrilous press has unfairly attacked a government official or a scurrilous government official has tried to fend off a perfectly righteous press. What are the legal precedents for cases like this?
The only cases that had ever come up usually come up under freedom of information, which permit any citizen to obtain certain information from the government. This was a statute passed by Congress back in the 70s. Because there was such a denial of information from, in this case, the federal government, where sometimes you could not even find out the address of a regional office of a federal agency. So most of your case law deals with a newspaper or even a TV correspondent seeking certain information from the government under the statute. But the problem is you got to know what you're asking for. So if you know that the state has a document in their record, you can then say to them, I want that record. But it's a lot different from, of course, what they're losing right now, which is having access. A reporter's working on a story and he wants to talk to someone in the agency, is this true or that's true, before he writes a story.
Well, if there is no legal mandate for governments to dispense information to particular reporters or news organizations in general, why shouldn't Maryland and every other state in the union, and by the way, the United States government, simply shut down all of its public information mechanisms, dismiss all of the public information officers, stop holding news conferences, and simply just go about its business without telling the public anything?
Well, frankly, since we are a democracy, it would be politically insane for any government, state or federal, to close down completely on public information because they're going to be affected by the next election because the press won't let them get away with it. They're going to start digging, and they're going to find their anonymous sources, so they will begin producing stories that will be very embarrassing to that government. So part of the beauty of the First Amendment is it takes care of that problem. But there's never been a constitutional demand that the government tell and give information. In fact, the only time the Constitution even talks about giving information is the State of the Union message of the president.
Professor Dash, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Abraham Dash is a professor of law at the University of Maryland Law School. He spoke to us from Baltimore.
Freezing out reporters is one of the few options legally available to public officials dealing with a hostile press. But what is here a natural antagonism between the press and the government approaches all-out war in Venezuela. The oligarchs that own the Venezuelan media were deeply suspicious of the leftist presidency of Hugo Chavez, and Chavez supporters charged the media with helping to engineer a coup in 2002. We should point out that Chavez, a former army colonel, himself tried to stage a coup d'etat back in 1992. 6 years later, he was the democratically elected president. What's a leader to do when the mainstream press becomes an active participant in efforts to overthrow him? Populist President Hugo Chavez has decided to fight back.
Medio de comunicación que se ponga aquí al servicio.
Broadcasters who serve the interests of coup mongers or enemies of the fatherland will be suspended.
This week, Chavez made his threat the law of the land and signed the so-called Law of Radio and Television Responsibility, what opponents call the gag law and what human rights groups call a threat to democracy. But the Chavez government believes it is protecting Venezuelan democracy by clamping down on its media, which continue to ally with the opposition in its efforts to take him down. From Caracas, Carol King reports.
Venezuela's oil wealth gave rise both to media oligarchs and to the nation's rising middle class, many of whom supported Chavez at first. But that relationship soon soured, and he was charged with buying off the poor and dismantling democratic institutions, leading the masses toward Cuban-style dictatorship. After months of strikes and protests actively rallied by TV and radio pundits, generals announced Chavez had resigned and a business leader would lead an interim government. With the media eager to go live with an unfolding coup, Chavez's attorney general said he'd also resign and called a press conference. Then he executed a perfect bait and switch.
Instead of resigning, he condemned the coup. He demanded President Chavez return to power.
Andres Isaro was a news producer with privately owned RCTV.
When we were live, I was ordered to cut the coverage because of what he was saying.
Viewers saw cartoons instead of Chavez's triumphant return when supporters descended by the thousands from the hillside slums of Caracas to support him.
I quit my job because we got instructions not to broadcast any information related to Chavez. We knew that the palace was retaken by the Chavistas, and we could not say anything because of the information blackout that was imposed by all of the private media.
After Chavez returned, station owners apologized, saying they were trying to quell tensions and protect reporters from attacks by pro-Chavez mobs who'd surrounded the stations. It's this kind of history that makes the issue of press freedom and responsibility so contentious here. As reporter Duncan Campbell of The Guardian put it, when the media are both covering the story and helping to create it.
El Circuito Radio Venezuela presenta todo el acontecer político y social.
To compete with opponents who owned the stations, Chavez has also taken to the airwaves with his own talk shows.
Patrullando con el presidente Chavez.
And hours-long discourses on new state TV channels, not to mention high-quality ads that extol his leadership. Sometimes he even orders the private stations to carry his speeches live. Former news producer Isara is now information minister for Chavez. He says the new radio and TV social responsibility law will democratize the airwaves.
The law opens 60% of everything that is broadcast on those airwaves to the production of national independent producers.
And this time, the Chavez government will decide who gets access through an 11-person directorate of social responsibility, mainly composed of government appointees who will have the power to grant licenses and punish rule breakers. One rule that troubles the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights would seek to enforce balance and, quote, truth in reporting. Difficult to evaluate, they say, and easy to use for arbitrary reprisals against dissent. Sebastian Brett is the chief researcher on Venezuela for Human Rights Watch.
Clearly, there's a concept here that the media have responsibilities as well as rights towards society. And I think what the law is, basically, is an attempt to impose those standards. Yeah, I think it's about 47 different offenses that the media can commit. It tries to impose a straitjacket on the media that encourages self-censorship.
The law also allows for government, quote, precautionary measures, which could make it possible for citizens to question any content by requesting an investigation.
It could be actually taken off the air until, you know, the matter's been resolved by this council that the government is setting up to review television content.
That would be prior censorship, he says, and a violation of the Inter-American Convention of Human Rights. But in the government campaign for the law, the selling point was protecting children from inappropriate images.
Serán sancionados con todo el peso de esa ley nueva.
We will punish with the full weight of this new law those who do not respect children's schedules, transmitting violent images, inciting racial hatred, poisoning the minds of our youth.
Mensaje de sexo.
The decency provision bans images of sex and violence during daytime and most evening hours. A station that broadcasts material considered, quote, an affront to the integral education of children or adolescents could face fines of $250,000 or up to 1% of its gross income. Ditto for messages considered to justify violence or aggression, incite lawless activity, impede law enforcement, or disrupt public order. Critics say the law is so vague in parts, anything could be construed as a crime. At a teach-in by journalists with Expresión Libre, or Union for Free Expression. 14-year-old Anibel says she and friends are worried the law could keep them from seeing news, like the 9/11 attacks or the school hostage-taking in Russia, or protests and possible repression in Venezuela.
I can't stay up until 11 at night to find out what happened in my country or around the world. It's cool to hear, here's what's going on right now, and not have to wait 5 hours to find out what happened.
The law does not have anything in it that restricts freedom of expression or flow of information, not a single word.
Again, Minister Isara.
Your ethic would not allow you to show a people who is shot on a close option with a pool of blood, but you can show the fact that this event had happened without having to show the gruesome images.
Venezuela has, up to now, enjoyed wide freedom of expression, despite the antagonism between Chavez and the press. This new law mutes the antagonism of the media, but not necessarily that of the president. The Organization of American States has warned that a president's inflammatory remarks can incite his supporters to attack dissenting journalists. And human rights groups cite dozens of assaults on the working press since Chavez took office in 1999.
A frenar el terrorismo mediático que atropella libertades.
To put the brakes on media terrorism that has run roughshod over our liberties, and to start to democratize the media airwaves that have been held hostage by an oligarchy that has already supported coups, fascism, and terrorism, those days are over.
But rights monitors say using blanket terms like media terrorism only encourages a climate of violence. Sebastian Brett, Human Rights Watch.
We've asked the government to investigate all attacks against journalists and to state publicly that such attacks aren't acceptable.
At the same time, he says, the opposition press should try to report the news in a less inflammatory and more balanced way.
But the point is that neither of those situations would justify direct intervention by the state. I mean, I think it's fundamentally an authoritarian statute here that we're dealing with.
Recent events show how democracy can be threatened by activist, biased media. But a law that shackles free expression is even more dangerous. Human rights groups say it's something that should concern not just journalists, but every Venezuelan citizen. For On the Media, I'm Carol King in Caracas.
It was just a little story, about 900 words, at the bottom of page A19 of Tuesday's Washington Post. The innocuous headline, Bush ties attack in Saudi Arabia to Iraqi elections. But the story beneath was quite unusual, because instead of simply parroting the president's assertion or perhaps including a perfunctory opposing view, the piece systematically debunked the notion that last week's attack on the American consulate in Jeddah was an attempt to disrupt the Iraqi election scheduled for January. As one of our occasional looks into the anatomy of a story, we asked Washington Post White House correspondent Peter Baker to join us. Peter, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
You're just back on the White House beat, which you covered from 1996 to 1999, before stints in Russia, Central Asia, and the Middle East. And you barely have your bags unpacked, and the president draws this connection. What happened next?
Well, clearly he's focused on what's happening in Iraq, and he sees everything through that prism. But people who spent time in Saudi Arabia see that, yes, it was an attack on a U.S. facility, but that the mosaic of animosities, hatred, history, and politics in Saudi Arabia go far, far beyond the U.S. involvement in the kingdom. So I called some experts and asked them to reflect on this and think about what the president had said, and they offered contrary views.
Okay, fine. But that's a far cry from what we on this show see as the compulsion in the media to preempt accusations of liberal bias by giving equal time and equal weight to two sides of any question, irrespective of whether truth is served by this kind of artificial balance.
That's in some ways a weakness of modern American journalism. But the fact of the matter is, I know that every day I write a story, it's going to appear in the paper under my byline. I'm accountable for it. If I've been unfair, if I've been inaccurate, if I've gotten the wrong context or wrong judgment, then people are going to call me on it. That's not a liberal conservative thing. That's a reader reporter thing.
All right. Now, you were covering the Clinton White House, and you know very well that whenever a negative story came out about the president, there were howls that, you know, the press was not objective and that they were unfairly attacking the president. That's certainly true of the current administration. Knowing that, someone in the White House press office picked up your paper and said, here it is, proof positive, the smoking gun. This Peter Baker here came back from the Middle East with an agenda.
Well, I certainly have no agenda to attack the president. The issue is, what degree are reporters of the White House stenographers as opposed to reporters who are trying to actually present a full, completely realized story? It's a perennial tension for White House reporters. You know, I'm looking forward to dealing with professionals who understand that we have different interests, but that doesn't mean we can't find ways of, working together and presenting information as completely and fully as we can.
All right, Rodney King. Why can't we all just
why can't we get along?
Peter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Peter Baker just returned from 4 years overseas, is a White House correspondent for The Washington Post.
Coming up, the American blockbuster, threat or menace? And when Hollywood calls, don't hang up. It costs somebody money.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's holiday time, and that means blockbuster time. The movieplexes are chock-a-block with films sporting dazzling stars, special effects, and marketing budgets. You know, blockbusters. If you're too busy, don't worry. There'll be even more this summer. Now, there are critics who yawn or cringe at all of this. The American blockbuster is, after all, an easy thing to hate. Then there is Tom Schoen. His new book, Blockbuster, How Hollywood Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Summer, is nothing short of a love letter to the blockbuster, which he says may be the quintessential American art form. Tom, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You say in your book that the whole term blockbuster itself has changed. It used to be a measure of success, and now it refers to a genre.
That's right. It's a type of movie. I mean, originally it just meant any movie that had sort of scored well financially, and it didn't have any kind of generic preference whatsoever. It could be The Sound of Music, it could be Kramer versus Kramer, it could be Earthquake. And at some point, it sort of evolved into an actual type of movie which let people know what they'd be expecting. It started to be the name which the studios gave to a film before it had even met its audience, before it had even had a chance to prove itself a success or not. So nowadays you'll hear Variety talk of a blockbuster failing, which would have made no sense whatsoever to somebody from 20 years ago. Like, how could a blockbuster fail? By definition, didn't it mean a successful movie?
You talk about Gone with the Wind, mm-hmm. sort of creating the idea of a runaway success.
Mm-hmm.
But when you talk about a film that creates a blockbuster in both senses of the word, mm-hmm. not just a runaway success, but a description of a genre, I guess you have to begin with Jaws.
Yeah, that's right. Here's some of the things that didn't happen after Gone with the Wind. Nobody did a sequel. Nobody turned it into a toy. Nobody had any idea, really, that they could repeat the success, even a year later. Gone with the Wind was simply reissued every decade or so. You know, the American sort of public had their blockbuster and they kind of kept it in a cabinet, and every now and again they'd get it out of the cabinet to look at it, and then they'd put it back again. But Jaws started the idea that you could have these movies sort of every year, that they would be aimed at the younger audience and they would hit them in the summer.
It would hit them in the summer. I was expecting you to say, and it hits them in the viscera.
I mean, you've hit on it there. A lot of the sort of earlier disaster movies of the 70s had been sort of weighed down with quite a serious sense of civic responsibility. The building goes up in flames and the mayor's on the phone to the architect and, what's going on? Jaws came along and it just had this kind of barrel full of high spirits. I mean, it's just a very, very funny movie, and it existed purely to scare you and make you laugh. And it did so with sort of no real pretensions beyond that.
The officer asked me to tell you that you're overloading that boat.
Then can you tell me if there's a good restaurant or hotel on the island?
You walk straight ahead.
They're all going to die.
All aboard here.
Then Spielberg encounters his first rival, you say, in George Lucas, his friend, and with Star Wars. And you say that it slouched its way to the box office.
Everybody expected this movie to fail. It was massively over budget. They tried to kill the movie several times. And instead it comes out and kind of rewrites box office history. It wasn't a blockbuster by today's terms at all in that sense, in that it hadn't been groomed for success. What Lucas effectively did was sped up movies to an extraordinary degree. The blockbusters of the 50s and 60s had been enormous things. They'd been huge, Ten Commandments-sized movies. Star Wars, as much as Jaws, just introduced this kind of new aesthetic. The movie went so quickly that you had to go back again and again to take in all its riches. Normally, you had a sort of sci-fi movie and somebody takes out a kind of ray gun from the holster and they spend 10 minutes explaining what the gun does. You know, in Star Wars, they just threw this stuff around as if it were just ordinary garage junk.
What a piece of junk!
She'll make 0.5 past light speed. She may not look like much, but she's got it where it counts, kid. I've made a lot of special modifications myself.
And that was incredibly intoxicating and a really new idea then. Characters who were just so at ease with the environment in which they lived that they just treated it in this incredibly offhand way.
Let's flash forward then to the 90s and this whole notion of speed. Spielberg himself says, you quote him in the book as saying, you know, now people have no patience because people like me taught them to have no patience. And now I'm stuck with a lot of people who have no patience. And he was encountering this problem when he made Jurassic Park.
Oh, that's right. If you compare Jurassic Park with Jaws, it's a much more impatient movie. We get to see our first dinosaur in about the first 20 minutes of the movie.
And you don't see the shark until...
right at the end of Jaws. Same with the UFOs in Close Encounters. It's 40 minutes or so before we even hear the word UFO. Jurassic Park is, you know, we get talk of the dinosaurs in the first 5 minutes and we get to see them within 20 minutes. It's a movie that kind of just hurries to its special effects gold.
We're going to make a fortune with this place.
Jurassic Park also was a huge success internationally, I mean, even more so than Jaws, and kind of reconfigured Hollywood's kind of expectations of how well blockbusters could do globally. You know, if you want to pick a point at which Hollywood became effectively the world's jukebox, Jurassic Park is the point.
It's a tune that a lot of the rest of the world is queasy hearing constantly playing in their backyards. And I know that Jurassic Park set up a terrible conflict between Spielberg and foreign filmmakers, and particularly in France. There was a joint letter from directors that you quote, Pedro Almodovar, Bernardo Bertolucci, Wim Wenders, who said, "Dear Stephen, we're trying to defend European cinema from complete annihilation. There'll be no European film industry left by the year 2000, and they lay the blame for that at the feet of Jurassic Park."
Jurassic Park had the misfortune of sort of terrible timing. It arrived just at the time that the French were trying to put restrictions on the amount of American movies that were opening in French cinemas. I mean, by this time, the blockbuster had become synonymous with all things American and rapacious. They were seen as these great giant dinosaurs sort of stomping on everything in their path. But, you know, it's also at this point that the American film industry became most internationalized. If ever there was a point at which kind of American movies were least American, it was from that point on, in that they were owned by international conglomerates, financed by the money from those conglomerates, often directed by foreign directors, released globally, and their overseas market far exceeded the domestic revenues. In a very important sense, you could ask of the blockbuster in the 90s, not how did the blockbuster conquer the world, but, you know, how did the world invade Hollywood and take it over?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Tom Schoen is author of Blockbuster, How Hollywood Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Summer.
Recently, the New York Times Magazine tackled the globalization of Hollywood in a piece called What is an American Movie Now? By Lynn Hirschberg. So I put the question to Lynn, was there a eureka moment for Hollywood when it understood that its future was not to export domestic films that did well, but films actually conceived and designed for the global audience?
I think they just simply looked at the numbers and started to realize that there was this huge audience out there, and why not capitalize on that fact? Unfortunately, when you capitalize on that fact, you end up with worse movies because they're less specific, less character-driven, less representative of anything that one thinks of when one thinks of great American films.
One of the more poignant observations in your piece is that filmmakers from other countries often explicitly aim to explore something about their national psyches, whether it's genital mutilation in Senegal or bourgeois hypocrisy in France or whatever. But Hollywood goes out of its way to trade in fantasy, period pieces, cartoons that do everything but reveal the film's American roots.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think it's a tragedy, because the movies that do reveal the American roots are almost like foreign films made in America. A movie like Sideways, which is very specific to what's going on in the American psyche, will probably not even play overseas.
They want to drink Merlot. We're drinking Merlot.
No, if anybody orders Merlot, I'm leaving. I am not drinking any Merlot.
Okay, okay. Relax, Miles. Jesus, no Merlot. Did you bring your Xanax? Do not drink too much. Do you hear me? I don't want you passing out or going to the dark side.
It probably will only have a American audience, and at that, a very small American audience, because it has a limited release, and it's the best American movie of the year.
In a way, I mean, just looking for a little bit of silver lining, isn't the rise of the global blockbusters produced by Hollywood a sort of antidote to American cultural imperialism? Because films like Matrix and Harry Potter don't impose our culture at all, aren't they sort of the cinematic equivalent of the Ford Focus, you know,
yes,
the world car?
Well, I think that's a fascinating point, but I also think that American culture is a great thing. So interesting if we actually had something interesting to impose, as opposed to something that's bland and futuristic. There's increasingly strange things. For instance, the villains in movies now have to be acceptable to a global audience. So you have villains that are like the weather in The Day After Tomorrow, or Spider-Man. Obviously, the villains are cartoon characters, et cetera, et cetera. You also have a situation where movies also become huge without even the benefit of quality or reviews. I suppose one could say that people like myself get sensitive about this point. But Alien versus Predator, which was a movie that did really well this summer, was opened without any reviews because I guess they figured Alien versus Predator, there was a built-in audience, and I think it's played very well around the world.
Lynn, frankly, you sound dispirited, and I'm just curious whether you lay awake at night hoping that the first billion-dollar blockbuster, the one that costs $400 million to make and $600 million to market, so completely fails on a global scale that Hollywood is jolted back into the reality that film is an art form, not just a merchandising vehicle. Is that your fantasy?
In part, I suppose it's my larger fantasy, but the glass half full part of me also has a fantasy that I'll see a movie that costs all that money and all that money to market, and it's actually fantastic. I think part of me wishes if they're going to go down this path, which is the path they're definitely going down, at least they should make some sort of effort to make the blockbusters have resonance in terms of what America is, in terms of what the country represents, and not just try and make them about the future or, in the case of Shrek, a green ogre or some fictitious character that has no resonance whatsoever past momentary amusement.
In other words, a film that you can carry with you for the rest of your life.
Yes, exactly. That would be the best. If you look at a movie, for instance, like Cabaret, which is a big movie, a big musical, that movie had real resonance. That movie had larger weight than just being about people singing and a blockbuster-like mentality. The same thing's true of Jaws. I think Jaws has enormous emotion. I think Jaws was not made in a cynical fashion. And interestingly, Minority Report, which is a movie that Steven Spielberg did recently with Tom Cruise, I thought was an excellent blockbuster, and it didn't do well because many people thought it was too intelligent.
Lynn, thank you so much.
It was great talking to you.
Lynn Hirschberg is editor-at-large for the New York Times Magazine. Her piece was titled, What is an American Movie Now?
Have you ever had a dream of chatting on the phone with Tom Cruise? Or maybe you fantasized about a call from Catherine Zeta-Jones? Well, you may have to get over those dreams, but thanks to a new website, you may get a call from some dimmer stars. On the Media's Hal Humphreys reports on HollywoodIsCalling.com.
Surfing the net the other day, I came across the website HollywoodIsCalling.com. It's a service that allows us, the fans, to order phone calls from some of our favorite but not quite so famous anymore stars. Scrolling down the list of celebrities, I spotted one of my childhood heroes. I actually started singing the theme song.
Welcome back. Your dreams are your ticket out.
Welcome back. Credit card in hand, I placed my order, 1995, for a call from Horshack to my best friend Jay.
Hello, Jay. Hi, this is Ron Palullo. I'm calling to say hello to Jay Osborne. I hope you have a wonderful and prosperous year, but most importantly, I'd like to wish you the best of luck in the pursuit of all your dreams and wishes for the coming year. Thanks. Oh. Take care. Goodbye now.
Boy now.
Jay loved it.
Is Vinnie Barbarino on the list?
No, Vinnie Barbarino is not on the list. You won't find megastar John Travolta. You won't find Russell Crowe or J-Lo. But you will find Lou Ferrigno, the Hulk. John DeLancey, Q from Star Trek, and ESPN commentator and all-star pitcher Tom Candiotti. You may wonder how Hollywood Is Calling landed such stars. Michael Stevens, the spokesperson for the website, says they sent out blanket mailings and waited for the callbacks.
Fans themselves get a tremendous kick out of picking up the phone and finding, you know, the live voice of a celebrity on the other end. And the celebrities themselves really love talking to people, you know, and there's that emotional two-way street that goes on between the two that sort of makes everybody feel good.
It is Hollywood, and this is work. The celebrities get paid, though they won't say how much. Stevens claims that HollywoodIsCalling.com is the first and only company in the world which allows the public to purchase live phone calls from celebrities. And Stevens says business is great and that stars are calling him now.
It really has become the hottest gift around.
If this is indeed the hottest gift around, you have to wonder, where does this idea of celebrity phone calls fit into Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
That's as much it as it is ego. In that there's something primitive going on.
Dr. Pete Hampshire is a clinical psychologist in Nashville, Tennessee. He has a theory about fame and need and the desire for security.
Kind of a primitive sense of that I'm never going to be abandoned again because I'm going to be famous. So if I'm famous, I'll never be lonely.
I asked for an interview with one of the celebrities, sort of a chance to pick the brain of someone in the know, find out what this is all about. Money? Ego? What? Stevens hooked me up with Cato Kaelin, you know, America's best-known house guest. Cato says, it's not just fun.
I guess it's because of it's fulfilling to me to hear how happy they are to talk to me. So it's a win-win.
Yeah, it's got to be kind of an ego boost to have people just say, oh my God, it's Cato on the phone.
Yeah, I don't even know so much of an ego boost. It's a really nice feeling to know that you can make someone's day.
But there is a risk. I asked Cato to call my dad.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Tom?
Yeah?
You're screening Cato's call?
Who?
Cato Kaelin. How are you?
Who?
Undaunted, Cato asked who else he could call. I said, hey, call my wife.
Hello?
Hi, Kim Green.
Yes.
Kim Green, this is Cato Kaelin from HollywoodIsCalling.com calling for you, Kim Green. Oh my goodness, it's so good to hear you. I want to tell you one really, really great thing.
Yes.
Hal is in love with you. He wanted me to let you know he is in love with you forever.
Hal who?
That's my girl. Let's get back to the list. There's the professor from Gilligan's Island. There's Raven of WWF notoriety. Lorenzo Lamas and Todd Bridges. All of this gets me thinking. What kind of celebrity call would a self-proclaimed public radio fiend, someone like my friend Phil Newman, what kind of call would they want?
The ultimate would be to have Carl Castle on your own answering machine, leaving a message for people calling you. That would be the ultimate.
So would you pay $19.95 to have Carl Castle call?
I would pay $99.95 to have Carl Castle call.
What are the chances of that?
Hello, this is Carl Castle calling to wish you a happy holiday season. Hello, this is Carl Castle calling to wish you a happy holiday season.
Hello. For On the Media, I'm Hal Humphreys.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Jamie York, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keith is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ann Kossoff and Dave Nolan, our webmaster. is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is NPR's On the Media, produced by WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And Women's E-News, news every day on issues of particular concern to women and with women's perspectives on public policy, at womensenews.org. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.